Thank you. Thank you very much. It's really nice to be here. I want to thank everyone for their hospitality. I want to thank the Levis family, the MFA committee, Mary, Greg, David, everybody associated with VCU for this. It's a wonderful thing to have your work published to begin with, and then to be recognized in this way is just thrilling. It's particularly thrilling for me because although I did not know Larry Levis, unfortunately never even had the opportunity to hear him read, I have known his work for over 20 years, and he has long been one of my favorite poets, and to have my work associated with his name in this way is truly an honor. I wanted to start by reading a poem of his. It's actually one of my favorites of his. Some of you may remember, and I think this was shortly after his death, Robert Pinsky was then poet laureate, and he had this poetry project where he was having people all across America record poems, favorite poems. I don't know, maybe some of you did that here. And I read this poem for that, so I wanted to read it again tonight. It's called The Quilt, and it has an epigraph from Henry James's The Portrait of a Lady, which reads, "He had stopped believing in the goodness of the world." The Quilt, Larry Levis. I think it is all light at the end. I think it is air. Those fields we drove past turning to mud in April, those oaks with snow still roosting in them, towns so small their entire economy suffered if a boy late at night stole the bar's only cue ball. In one of them you bought an old quilt, which fraying still seemed to hold the sun, especially in one bright corner made from what they had available in yellow in 1897. It reminded me of laughter, of you. And some woman whose faith in the goodness of the world was stubborn sewed it in. There now, she might as well have said, as if in answer to the snow, which was merciless. There now, she seemed to say to both of us. Here's this patch of yellow, one field gone entirely into light. Goodbye. We had become such artists at saying goodbye, it made me wince to look at it. Something at the edge of the mouth, something familiar that makes the mouth turn down, an adjustment. It made me wince to have to agree with her there, too, to say the day itself, the fields, each thread she had to sew in the poor light of 1897 were simply gifts. Because she must be dead by now and anonymous, I think she had a birthmark on her cheek. I think she disliked Woodrow Wilson and the war. And if she outlived one dull husband, I think she still grew, out of spite and habit, flowers to give away. If laughter is adult, an adjustment to loss, I think she could laugh at the worst. When I think of you both, I think of that one square of light in her quilt, of women, stubborn, believing in the goodness of the world. How next year, driving past this place, which I have seen for years and steadily through the worst weather, when the black of the Amish buggies makes the snow seem whiter, I won't even have to look up. I will wince and agree with you both, and past the farms abandoned to moonlight, past one late fire burning beside a field, the flame rising up against the night to take its one solitary breath, even I will be a believer. It's a weird thing with a first collection. It represents, I think for most people, it certainly does for me, a long time period of work. And so there's a lot of poems in a first collection that you really just want to disown. You know, they're so old, and you just look at them and say, what were you thinking? And just out of some sort of perverse thing tonight, I thought I'd start with a couple of old poems. This is one of the first poems in terms of time in this book, and it's called The Uses of Metaphor. And it's a poem that I wrote after I read an Amnesty International report on torture. And I was very struck by a section of that that talked about the jargon that torturers use. There are actually professional torturers. That's their job. They get up in the morning and they go and they do these horrible things. And like most people in specialized fields, they have a jargon. And it's a real perversion of the purpose of metaphor, in my view. The poem's called The Uses of Metaphor. They call themselves doctors, speak of taking the submarine, the plane ride, dragon's chair, the parrot. They call it the putting of the question, civic therapy, a spiritual seance, collective training. At night, they look into the faces of their children. They touch the soft bodies of their wives. Turning up their radios, their ears fat with cotton, they pretend to hear nothing. Only the language of their dreams is literal. All night, the alphabet moves behind their eyes. Their tongues work in their mouths, forming and reforming the words water, electricity, blood. This one's called Art, and it carries an epigraph from wonderful poet Adam Zagajewski, which reads, "Ordinary isn't possible anymore." In the teacher's lounge, the tall, pretty Irish woman tells me her anorexic daughter's been hospitalized 2 years. She's 15. Their debts are something she can only laugh about. I sip tepid coffee, tell her about the afternoon I watched deputies cuff my son, pat him down against a black and white while he invited them to suck my cock, fuck him in the ass, and cried. Today, I teach figurative constructions to high school juniors signed up for creative writing in hope of an easy grade. I quote Wallace Stevens. Wonder what metaphor I can use to find the unities in this. What was he like raging by that car? Was the sun fiery? The police faces stone? Soon I'll speak to English teachers from far schools about the value of art and imagination, to students whose 12-step stories of locked wards and halfway house failures I've listened to all week. I don't know what to say about these stories, how to explain that they come to me daily as if I wear some sign. And I don't know what it means as I watch them laughing in school hallways, slamming their lockers, tonguing each other in a sweet approximation of love. When I call him at the hospital, my son tells me a story. A friend has died. The rumor is someone scotch-guarded his dope. Forgive me if this seems extreme. I don't know how to make things ordinary anymore, though I dress and go to work each day as if the world were ordinary, as if our lives might unfurl easily as some well-mannered plot, carefully rounded characters strolling bucolic paths, safe beneath lucid trees, their steps measured and graceful as the orderly progression of their lives, a shapeliness such as no one might imagine anymore. Okay, one more of these sort of older ones. A very good friend of mine was adopted as an infant, and when she was turning 30, she tried to find out about her birth mother and father, and I was sort of helping her research this, and we found out a few things. She was born out in West Nebraska. She had been named Helen, although that's not her name, the name she grew up with, and her mother was a high school girl. She didn't know much about her father. The adoption agency, interestingly enough, had her mother fill out this little questionnaire of her interests and things. And one of them was writing, and my friend is a poet, so that was pretty interesting. But she didn't find out much more than that. And in the course of helping her research this, I read a lot about adoption. And among the books that I read was a very good one by a woman named Jan L. Waldron called Giving Away Simone. And in her book, Waldron talks about the fact that most of us have some kind of family story about the day we were born, you know, the crazy thing your father did or how the car almost didn't get there on time. You know, it's kind of family mythology. But people who are adopted in infancy don't have those stories. And so for my friend's 30th birthday, I decided that I would, you know, take the prerogative of those of us who live in our heads and make up that story for her. So this poem is about that. It carries an epigraph from Waldron's book, which reads, "Adoptees do not have the luxury of envisioning their celebrated births. They often know nothing of their debuts." And the poem is called Debut, Late Lines for 30th Birthday. You say you can't sleep nights imagining them, the wayward girls of Omaha, Nebraska, 1965. The chill green rooms of Booth Charity Hospital, bare as cloister cells, where they'll labor hard, learn their lesson, the doctor says, and leave the infants they may name but not hold. It's the weekly outing that gets you, movies the Junior League springs for, something sweet at Dairy Queen, how docile as calves they're led in line by twos, a few holding hands like the schoolgirls they are. But look, here's your mother. The copper hair she'll pass to you mirroring the late September sun, that same glamorpus mole etched on the still soft curve of her cheek. She won't line up, doesn't want ice cream, waits outside, slouched against a red Mustang she'd like to own, smoking the old golds she knows say bad girl, even now. Along the empty street, this part of town where no one comes, the first leaves drop to skitter along the gutter, make her think of snow, of the movie they've just seen. Leans Zhivago and Lara, warm with vodka and lovemaking, in a glistening blizzard of a house, snow veiling everything, the gas lamps and satin couches, even the poet's desk slick with frost. Of their lost daughter, how years later she refuses the proffered gift of her past. No Slavic romance in your mother's past, just some West Nebraska town so small it's no more than a stutter in the long silence of the prairie. Her father's strap, regular as church, once she began to show. The pursed mouth of her mother, a greyhound into this dirty city where for days she slept and read from a book of names, choosing Helen for you. Maybe thinking of those thousand ships, maybe of some favorite teacher, one who called her writing good. You can't know any of this, any more than she knows, it's just hours from your birth. I like to think you'll arrive through a shared dream of iced and glittering Russian trees, Yuri smiling at the first sun he's seen in months before turning to his work, that you debut to a welcoming chorus of troika bells and balalaikas, a cry of wolves. Okay, some relatively newer things. This one's called Kiss, and I wrote this after seeing the film First Night several years ago. Some of you may have seen it. It was another retelling of the Camelot legend, which is a legend that I have always found fascinating. I always felt Guinevere got a bad rap. And the way the film is set up, if you haven't seen it, is early on, Lancelot tries to kiss Guinevere, and she says, you know, no, I'm promised to Arthur, I can't kiss you, even though she clearly wants to. And he says to her, okay, I'm not going to ask you again, I'm going to wait till you ask me. And a large part of the movie is we are all indeed waiting for her to ask him, which she does. So this is partly about that. It's called Kiss. And when the moment, like an overdue train bearing to us someone loved and too long gone, a train we've waited days and nights for, pacing the platform, our pulses thrumming when, arrives. The camera close up, lush sweep of strings, adagio, the light high key, resplendent as the dew-rinsed, saturated, dizzyingly green panoramas the cinematographers mapped as Camelot. The moment we have waited for with the lovers since their first meeting, Guinevere crouched among damp reeds, unafraid despite her torn dress. Smiling as she watches, he's young, all muscle and wit, a man's easy grace. Smiling, too, despite the chain and mail-clad villains, the honed bloody swords, night of girlhood's promise. You remember that moment when the camera frames the kiss she's asked him finally for. They are not tender, but open their mouths wide, so we think of eating, their heads working, a kind of fever, love's other face. We recognize it, don't we? Lancelot, the man, The archetypal only, always, we dreamt of as girls those rainy childhood afternoons, Kens and Barbies moving stiffly in our small hands, our mother's stolen stilettos gorgeously tripping us up. It's that kiss you want for so long that when you take it greedy as a thief and always with as much payment due. And we want them to go on, though we know the ending, that the camera must pan to a three-shot, Arthur's ragged face. We want them to go past what they and we can bear, to follow his head gentle down her neck, her mouth against his bare shoulder. We want the music to swell, lavish, hokey, romance engulfing us like some oversweet perfume. So wholly our lives become epic, a kiss worth whatever it costs. The title poem of my book, Muse, is about the life of Vivian Elliott, who probably, as most of you know, was T.S. Eliot's first wife, and requires just a little bit of introduction. Vivian Elliott was historically known as sort of the crazy woman that made the poor genius crazy until he put her away. She was vilified. Even the great feminist Virginia Woolf called her the bag of ferrets around Eliot's neck. And towards the end of her life, Eliot and her brother did in fact commit her, stripped her of everything, although she was not mentally ill, and she died in an institution. For years, there was nothing about her except these sort of horrible stories in Eliot biographies and Tales of the Bloomsbury Group. There is a biography now, which came out, I think, last year or so. I haven't read it yet, but something did finally come out. But I was interested in her because, you know, I just couldn't understand why this woman elicited such loathing from all these people. And finally, her brother, at the end of his life, was overcome with guilt because he knew she should not have been committed. And he told her story to a playwright who then wrote a play, I believe the playwright's name was Michael Hastings. That play became the movie Tom and Viv that some of you may have seen. For those of you that haven't seen it or don't know much about her life, what we can tell about what was wrong with her was that she had some sort of terrible physical problem from adolescence that had her in constant pain. And the treatment for the pain at that time was to dose her daily with morphine, ether, and alcohol. So, you know, she behaved badly often. This was also shrouded in shame at the time. At any rate, this poem is about her. It's in four short sections. This first section is actually just a grouping of quotes, things actually written about her. And it begins with two epigraphs. The first is from Vivian's brother, Morris Haig Wood, who says, Tom's Bloomsbury bunch called her the River Girl. They were afraid of her. And then Eliot said of her, she has everything to give that I want, and she gives it. The first section is called River Girl, a litany. Incarnate provocation, bag of ferrets, flirt. Morally insane, frivolous, a silly little woman attractive to men, but not a girl to bring to mother. Shallow, self-centered, a prima donna preoccupied with romance, gross with women's troubles. That torture reeking of ether, her voice a shriek. It's true she chose her men poorly, a lover who found her hellish, loathsome, her genius husband with his truss, his vow of celibacy, his green face powder and stained lips. Her own face white, mottled from an excess of bromide, her eyes vague, acutely sad. The second section is set in April 1905, when Vivian would have been about 16 or so, and which is when they probably started her on these drugs. And it's called Bluebell Woods. Delicious, this absence of pain. On the smooth pitch behind father's house, the adults linger over cricket. She hears the soft knock of wood, low murmurs, laughter. Inside, Martha scrubs this morning's bloody sheets, another ruined lace gown. For once, she doesn't care. Her head light, gut unclenched, she sways past the rhododendron sentries, drifts invisible, it seems, across the meadow's riotous gorse, wild red vetch, white stitchwort, pink lady smock. She thinks the flowers may be speaking. Bless Dr. Arnold. Bless Mother. Bless most of all those bottles gleaming on the bedstand, their strange names, anodyne, bromide, lovely as the names of flowers. She moves deep into the wood's damp shade until she's lost in blues. Violet, aquamarine, gentian, cobalt, endymion nonscriptus, bluebells. Sodden leaves and these many silent, soothing bells erase the footpath. And because she's 16, her head cloudy with ether and alcohol, she feels she's floating on azure, a magic carpet that might take her anywhere. It's so quiet now she can hear the lisp of grass snakes, each bird calling, the hush and chirr of morning gossip passing neighborly among the sheltering larch. 3. Ward in Chancery, What They Took From Her. Photographs she'd lived with 20 years, her husband's love letters, trunks of filmy scarves, sheer petal-colored dresses, her lacework, pairs of pastel boots with their many pearl buttons, those straw hats pinned with gleaming fruit, stockings the color of sorbet, even her fascist drag, black waistcoat and cape, the ivory cigarette holder. They took her passport, her driver's license, her right to vote or appeal for release. They took her powders and elixirs, her car keys, the keys to her flat, her money. Her mother lined a steamer with silk pillows, packed her diaries and sheet music, the hinged box of watercolors, satin-toed dancing shoes she'd worn down at the heels, French scent tea hated for its female masking trick. They took her books, cartoons she'd drawn, the stories and poems she'd written, her copies of the Criterion, the margins scrawled with purple-inked comments in her spidery hand. This is the last section in which Vivian herself speaks. It's set in January in 1947, which was when she died at Northumberland House, which is the asylum to which she was committed. It's called The Rim. Reflexed and crown-like, happy enough in the drawing room's dim afternoon light, the cyclamen's petals bloom, pink as nursery paper, above its mottled leaves. A ring of hearts, the damp, sober green of moss. These fugitive winter days, reluctant darkness shudders into morning, resolves each twilight into evening's phantom vacancies. In between the tea kettle's fading hiss, this cloying scent of hothouse flowers. I watch snow ghosting the patio, the abandoned gazebo, wood smoke rising over the silver birches to brindle a chalky sky. I watch myself moving like a wraith between the armchair and the window, between this overheated room, its moldering velvets and aging damasks, these yellow doilies we residents stitch, and every feverish, echoing room sprung from the rising backwash of the past. I am nearly weightless now, so thin any small arms might encircle me, my body grown so light I can easily slip across the beckoning rim. Just a couple more. It's another one in short sections. It's called Three Poems for Judy, and this is in memory of my sister-in-law, who died several years ago, quite young, from cancer. First section is called First Sign. Day after day, the fecund, misshaped cells doubled and redoubled inside her, infused her blood's unguarded channels and spawned their rank tumors, unmaking each tissue-woven host. Her left lung first, then her brain, then her spine and bones, brute vandals at the marrow. For weeks or months, the doctors know so little, she felt nothing, until that morning in August, a special class for teachers, when her hand refused to move or hold her pen, and curled limp against her paper, a small, stunned thing. It seemed, she said, so strange, and yet familiar, too, like that scene from a thousand old westerns, the dozing scout startled to a fury of dust, the first faint sounds of horses approaching. The second section carries an epigraph from Susan Sontag's book, Illness as Metaphor, which reads, "In cancer, non-intelligent cells are multiplying, and you are being replaced by the non-you. Immunologists class the body's cancer cells as non-self." And this section is called "The Non-Self, Some Things She Said to Me." "This is hell," Jay says from her hospital bed. And I don't mean hell, I mean hell. Like a comic lush, she slurs her words, Ativan and morphine swelling her tongue. Pupils shrunk to motes. Bald now beneath her cotton turban, sparrow thin, her body's soft tissues devoured by cancer, she seems some third sex, the non-self the doctors speak of. Outside, the leaves burn rust and gold, brighten as they fall against an indifferent sky. She crooks a finger I can almost see through, hisses, "She wants to kill me. She's crazy, that nurse. You think I'm crazy, but she's the one. I want to go home. I want to walk again. Why won't you take me home? You don't know what it's like. You don't know what this pain is like. You're putting this in your next book, aren't you?" The last section is called Meeting the Angel and refers to the angel of death. I discovered that virtually every religion, every culture has a belief of some kind in an angel of death, and they're quite varied. I myself am usually not one who puts much stock in angels and spirits and that sort of thing, but going through this with my sister-in-law, I did in fact think I met the angel. That's what this is about. "Not as a bird with 12 black wings and an eye and a tongue for each of us. Someone dies each time he blinks. And not shrouded in celestial light, a fair-haired castrato. Not as Samuel, angel of poison, his venomous sword quivering above the parched open mouths of the dying. He did not come as Azrael, whom God helps, bearing apples so sweet their fragrance kills our fear of leaving this known world. What did we know of death, of suffering? Each day for weeks we drove the autumn highway to the clinic, where the angel's rough map ablated Jay's skin with the blue tattoos of radiology, black dissolve of surgical stitches. And like or unlike God, he was always with us, among the lush ongoing trees, the small mercies of fresh air and afternoon light leavening the cracked glass, our hearts stutter as we reach the exit." Okay, I think I'll just read two more. This is actually a new one that came out after the book, and it's about Truman Capote. As most of you likely know, Truman Capote, among his other wonderful work, wrote a really breakthrough book, the first so-called nonfiction novel, In Cold Blood, about a murder that occurred in Holcomb, Kansas. And he spent a long time working on this book. It just consumed him. And he had it all done. He went to Europe, finished it, and he had it all done except for the ending. And he couldn't write the ending because the murderers were on death row appealing their execution. And so he had to wait for them to either be executed or for the execution to be, you know, whatever you call that, not executed, just kept in prison before he could end the book. And of course, he had gotten to know these men pretty well, and he had very conflicting feelings about this. He couldn't work on anything else, and he couldn't finish his book, and he knew what the book was going to be. I read this poem recently in Omaha, which is where I'm from, and when I got done, the most amazing thing happened. A woman came up to me and said that she had grown up in Holcomb, Kansas, and known the Clutter family, who are the family that were killed. And I said, oh, you know, gee, I hope nothing in this poem offended you or anything. And she was fine, but it was very strange. At any rate, he came back from Europe. He was living in Brooklyn and waiting, going crazy, not being able to finish this book. And this imagines him there. It's called Capote in Brooklyn, spring 1963. Back from 3 years monastery life, working in Europe, he's in love again with these Pacific heights and genteel streets named for fruit trees that could never grow here, with Willow Street especially, the yellow house where he lives with Jack, where each dawn they hear, amazing, a cock crow from some neighboring yard. Mornings he walks the esplanade above the docks and the traffic seething below towards the city, the tall dazzle of its skyline, a jagged, brilliant rising from the East River. He notes the flower man with his archaic, dull horse and cart, the young mothers pushing carriages, their candy-bright hair teased high, and makes his way to the end of the docks, where the neighborhood shifts into abandoned warehouses and dim alleys, where there's a haunted hotel, a fabled ghost who passes each morning by a fifth-floor window. He's waiting, unable to finish the book he knows will make him until the courts decide. Will they swing or no? They write him from their death row cells. He sends them cigarettes and books, dictionaries for Perry, porn for Dick. Swing or no? Once Perry told him Dick ran down a dog on the highway just for fun. That's the kind of man he was. Not like him, Perry said. He was never mean if he could help it. Made Mr. Clutter comfortable before he cut his throat. The wind off the river smells of bait and coffee from the trawlers, and the June mornings fairly gleam. Far west, a Methodist crypt amidst the wheat fields and prairie wildflowers, the sealed cluttered house also waits, for the living to claim what its dead no longer have a use for. Pie tins stacked and shining on a kitchen shelf, a girl's locked diary buried among schoolbooks, her father's boots ready by the mud scrape, beside a narrow bed left where he can find them in the morning, a boy's thick glasses. I actually grew up in New York, although I've lived a lot of places and lived in the Midwest for a long time now, but I'm going to close with a New York City poem. It's called L'Heure Bleue. Pigeons furl the silk of their oil-slick wings and doze on the limed shoulders of forgotten generals, while the last commuters descend to the subways, where they'll sway above their papers, reflections streaming through the rapid dark. Christened blue by the French, this is the hour when evening raises its azure wand and the light smolders, cool center of a candle flame. The five ring on an archer's target, a few stars, the silvery nibs of arrows just breaking through. Slender boys in waiter's tuxes snap starched linens over tables for two, as cabbies scour back seats clean of the day's real detritus. And one by one, all over the city, vapor lamps spread their sodium veils like some fast-traveling rumor. Gild the drowsing streets, graffitied buildings, until even the harbor, the river freighted with sludge, even the smokestacks percolating a foul snow of ash and grit over the Jersey Palisades, have gone soft focus, the whole town a chamber of commerce photo, or moony perfume ad. Prelude to the strict black of night, this is the moment we may imagine the hiss of nylon, the garter a woman slides high on her leg for a man dressing, even now, in his best suit, when we find ourselves humming Gershwin tunes, thinking romance, possibility, of glamour we know better than by day, which is why the woman lingers, her heart beating like a bird's does, too quickly, why the man hesitates beneath her window, his face chiaroscuro in blue shadow, a square of light. Thank you very much.